Welcome back. You're listening to the Healthy Aging Show, and we're talking about anesthesiology with Dr. Betty Ann Robustelli. There's other obstacles that you have to deal with besides things like smoking. People that are overweight present challenges to you because just of the body mass and the higher weight absorption of the drugs that you give. Eating, drinking, or smoking before my anesthesia, we talked about.
I think you have to look at also the fact that someone's coming in for surgery, very often it's because they've needed it. So
no, they go in for surgery because it looked like a good thing to do on a Saturday afternoon.
Well,
come
when it's plastic surgery, it is. Then it's a really good thing. No, a lot of times there's been an illness they're not even aware of that has actually gotten them tired and worn down. So they're not really going into surgery in the best of physical condition as well. So you have to be true to yourself on that as far as the patient and what your expectations
are. Well, something Dr. Robustelli said earlier about discovering in the process of the pre-testing or during the procedure these potentially life-changing or life-threatening issues. Is that more common with people who have shunned medical treatment?
We see that a lot, that patients will ask them if they have any medical problems and they say no. And then you have to ask the next question to say, when was the last time that you saw a doctor? So some people will come in and, you know, we'll do our pre-op assessment. They're on no medications. They seem like they're a healthy person. And then you see them in the pre-op area and you wonder,
who is the same person?
Yeah, this doesn't look like this patient, you know. And then a lot of people, they haven't seen anyone. And they do have multiple medical conditions, but that just have not been addressed. And in that situation, if the case is an emergency procedure and you have to go ahead with it, we have to sort of just take that into account. But a lot of times, you know, if you have undiagnosed diabetes or untreated high blood pressure, if we hear a large murmur that hasn't been addressed, anything like that, a lot of times the surgeries will be canceled until all those medical conditions are really evaluated and better controlled, because under anesthesia, it can really be devastating what the effects can be if those things are not well controlled. So,
and as a profession, you have a lot of accountability.
Yes.
You know, this is a very, unfortunately, it's a very litigious society, and you're in the crosshairs probably more than most professions.
And we are. I mean, we're just, if there's any event in the operating room, irrelevant, whether it has to do with the anesthesia, if it's the surgeon, or we're all together, all in it together.
Right. So it's a difficult position to be in, and as a result, you've got to be doubly careful.
Yes.
Triply careful.
Yes.
And so if you're not, you're probably not practicing.
Right.
I was actually thinking this morning, too, how often has a patient gone in for surgery and you find out that the surgery has taken longer? I mean, it took an additional 2 hours. Well, it's an additional 2 hours for the staff and the doctors who are in there making it happen. So you have some really a physically challenging job sometimes with length
of time.
Oh, we
do, yeah. I mean, sometimes.
You've got surgeries. I don't know that they talk about it as much, but back when the heart transplants were started, they were taking 12, 14, 18 hours. They had multiple teams coming in because of fatigue. You just couldn't stay on your feet and alert doing all of this. And you guys have to be there all the time.
Right.
It's a very demanding thing. And you complain about your days in retail standing on your feet. I imagine that standing on your feet in an operating room is no different.
Right. I mean, sometimes the surgeries, even at Stanford, I mean, we do 10, 12-hour surgeries sometimes.
And it's a chilly room.
Yeah.
Definitely need to be well-dressed and warm in that room. Now, there's been some changes, too, now with the anesthesia moving into the pain management and the self-patient-controlled anesthesia as well. So we've really modified things substantially.
Yes, a lot of, there's acute pain management and there's chronic pain management, and we're really involved in both of those. The chronic pain patients are really much more, there's an outpatient basis for them, and they're managed mostly with narcotics, like we spoke about, but there are also interventional procedures where they'll put pain pumps in and spinal cord stimulators and various different invasive techniques to help with pain now, which has really come a long way. Also, they'll do permanent nerve blocks for cancer patients to really kind of ablate the nerves that are going to the area that's causing the pain for these, end-of-life care to make them more comfortable. We're becoming much more involved in for these chronic pain patients.
Does pain have an actual, pain in itself is a physical stress on the body as well as emotionally?
Yeah,
right?
It's multifactorial. It really is. You know, there's a huge emotional component to it, psychological, physical. I mean, it really crosses many avenues with pain. And that's why I think that's why you're saying with biofeedback and acupuncture and the relaxation techniques, I think they're very important for people. I think the stress of chronic pain really becomes debilitating. And I think they should really take in all the avenues they can to really help them get through it.
Now, Dawn, you had asked during the break about more holistic means of pain management and anesthesiology with things like hypnosis and
acupuncture.
Yeah, and you find a place for that.
Yeah, I do. I mean, there's been a lot of studies showing, you know, there's a lot of us, there's a point on your wrist that you can push to help with nausea. That's been really very well documented, you know, an acupressure point. There's been a lot of people will come in and ask us to put headphones. And they have like a motivational tape that just repeats during the whole operation. Even when they're unconscious, they ask for this to be on. And I was actually involved during my training in a study that looked at the brain waves in relation to music that was being played right, during the surgery. And they're saying that there was definitely a calming effect on the patients that had music on, as opposed to headphones we just put on that didn't have anything playing. And they looked at the different brain waves and said that there was that calming influence. So I do think there is an avenue that you could investigate if you're interested.
Maybe learn Italian while I'm...
Yeah.
You could do that. Talk to John LaBarca, and I'm sure he can plug you into a program that has Italian, the Italian house
party.
Yeah,
there you go. What about for the staff? Do you have any sort of additional music?
Yeah, there's music. A lot of the operating rooms have music in them.
Who gets to choose it?
It's variable. It's usually the surgeon or the anesthesiologist.
Okay. Ooh, oh, we know the pecking order.
Yeah,
we do.
Question. Well, let's go back to the components of anesthesia. It consists of something that puts you to sleep, something that produces amnesia, mm-hmm. and something that calms the body so that it doesn't react in an adverse way to mm-hmm. poking and prodding and mm-hmm. cutting. In your process, as you monitor the patient, can you tell electronically or intuitively or physically whether someone is at the level of unconsciousness that they need to be for this procedure? And can you tell if they are starting to come out of that? And is that something that, because we have, everybody hears stories about the person who was awake. Now, my son just told me that he was awake or woke during a procedure. It had to do with an esophageal process. Mm. And he said that he tried to sit up and he was restrained. Now, I don't think he was imagining that, but there are people who do wake during surgery.
There are. I try to explain. I mean, a lot of patients ask about that. Again, there's different type of anesthetics that sometimes some procedures are done with just sedation. And I explain to the patients that you might wake up a little bit and then fall back off to sleep, sort of a dynamic state. And it's not the general anesthesia where you're totally unconscious and I could say that you will not remember any of your operative time. It's like your son I probably know what he had done, where they looked in his, you know.
It was an endoscopy.
Endoscopy, right. That's done with just sedation. So you'll give some sedation, they fall asleep, but they can wake up from it. You know, young men have a tendency to wake up wanting to fight, you know,
right.
like it's...
What the heck?
They do. It's a very common thing, and they have very high requirements. Their metabolism is very fast.
There goes the chemistry, because mm-hmm. you're not going to necessarily get that from somebody that's 80 years old from an infant. So being able to determine the right mix, and that's the art.
Yes, that's the art.
Of the science.
Yes.
And this is not something that comes out of a cookbook. It comes out of a lot of years of experience.
Right. That's what I find, that like your son, there's not, okay, you don't give this much more for the young, healthy, athletic guy. You know, there's a suggested range, and it really is. It's sort of the art of how much they need to be asleep, yet still breathing, yet being able to go home that day. So there's really a lot of it is feel, and I think that you get with years of experience.
Now, remembrance of the procedure can be very traumatic.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons that you want to suppress that.
Yes.
Because of what people will have to deal with later on.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of, that movie came out that was talking about awareness under anesthesia. We got tons of questions from people when that movie came out. And there are cases of awareness under general anesthesia where patients are supposed to be asleep, but they're awake and paralyzed. Most of those cases are usually very sick patients that if they probably had any more anesthesia, they would die. So you hear about that in big heart operations or big lung transplant or kind of bigger operations at times where the patients are so critically ill that if they really had any more anesthesia, they would
succumb to it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But there are those cases where, for some reason, the anesthesiologist was not aware that they were not receiving enough of the anesthesia. We have a lot more monitors now. We have something called a BIS monitor or an entropy, and it's a monitor we put on the forehead, and it really tells us the depth of anesthesia, and that's become a very helpful tool to be able to use. And also vital signs. I mean, if you are awake and paralyzed, your blood pressure would be up, your heart rate would be up. There's a lot of signs that really, you just need an attentive anesthesiologist.
That's actually reassuring and comforting to hear, because I know it's not a high number.
No, it's very...
It's very, very slim.
But it's still frightening. Still, you know, for the case, a couple of cases that, you know, where it has happened here, it's devastating.
Let's talk a minute about what it takes to be an anesthesiologist, because it's a very rigorous program, I believe.
Yeah. You know, you have to go to college for 4 years, and then medical school for 4 years, and then you need 4 years of postdoctoral training. So you do an intern year as either a medicine intern or a surgical intern. You can choose which one that you want. And then you do 3 years of anesthesia. And then after that, if you want to specialize, you can do an extra year of training for obstetrics, pediatrics, cardiac, and critical care and pain. So those are the specialties that you can actually do another year.
That's 17 years of training, mm-hmm. 4 years of college up front.
Right.
But
right.
Take that out. You've still got 13 years of medical training. So the people that are providing this service are very, very well trained and very dedicated. How did you choose this as a profession?
Medicine or anesthesia?
Anesthesia.
I liked procedural. We do a lot of procedures with the pain blocks. I enjoyed doing that. It's a lot of hands-on. I really didn't like the office-based medicine as much. And I liked the feeling in the operating room.
In the operating room.
I enjoyed that.
It's like being in the middle of the action all the time.
That really is.
And being the point person all the time, too.
And with the emergency situations, you have no idea necessarily what's coming at you. I wanted to ask you about the new medical tourism that's happening. How many people are going overseas for procedures? And that probably has some thoughts, some concerns as well as to what the differences may be and what they should be looking at.
A lot of people are going abroad for certain procedures. I think there's not the degree of, in the United States, there's so much investigation that's done into everything, and it really there's a lot of hoops you have to jump through before things get approved here in the States. And a lot of times you can go to foreign countries where things are done much more easily there. I think eventually they will be approved here, but I think some people are in desperate need of certain procedures and don't want to wait. And I think, again, you have to do your research. You know, you look into your physician there, and I think it is safe in certain instances. And I do think, like, there is a need for certain procedures that we do not do here in the States.
Our training levels outside the United States as rigorous as they are here?
They're very similar. They're very similar. You know, anyone that, even if you're trained as a physician in another country, when you come back here, your medical school is accepted, but you have to do a residency here. I think we have a lot of our medical equipment, we have a little more sophisticated kind of equipment. And that's what I found. You know, I trained with some people that, you know, were practicing anesthesiologists in their country, and they came here, but they had to repeat their residency. And it's just, we have, thank God we do, but we really do have a lot more equipment and a lot more monitoring that's available to us that they need to learn here. But most of their educations are really very good.
I had a question that had to do with the move towards, we call it quicker and sicker discharges, where people are cycled through the system way faster than they ever were before, in part because the technology allows it, but in part because insurance mandates it, because they are putting pressure on the hospital and on the doctors to discharge the patients quicker because they don't want to have to spend the money. How has that changed the practice of anesthesia?
It's fast tracking. We have to fast track patients. It is very difficult. The insurance will not pay for, you know, certain procedures are considered ambulatory procedures. And if they're converted to an overnight stay, there really has to be justification why they're staying overnight. If pain management is an issue, they can stay overnight. Nausea and vomiting, not being able to tolerate anything to to drink mostly. You can't send these patients home because they'll just end up back in the emergency room. With,
right.
You know.
And that's the other side of the Health Reform Act. Now they want to penalize hospitals for readmission.
Yes.
But, you know, there's got to be a balancing act here.
Right. So, I mean, you really try in the ambulatory care setting that you know this patient's going to try and go home. You try and balance their pain has to be controlled, but they can't be asleep. They have to be able to eat and drink and walk. And so you really try and have a comfortable patient. And you try and decrease the amount of medication that you give them in anticipation of them having to go home. As opposed to someone that you know that's going to be in the hospital, they're going to have their own pain pump, giving themselves their own amount of medication when they need it. It's just a different approach when you're thinking someone has to go home.
But with some of the procedures with the ambulatory, very specifically, no big decisions, no big purchases, no driving.
Right.
And we had talked about some of the reasons for that. And you feel great in the afternoon, and why can't you drive?
Right. I was telling Dawn a story that took care of an OBGYN for procedure, and it was an ambulatory care center, the Tully Center. And he went home that night, it was 7 to 8 o'clock, and he just said, "This is ridiculous. I feel fine. I'm going to drive." So he went out, and he said he had to call his friend because he got lost in his own neighborhood, and he could not remember for the life of him how to get home. And again, it's those drugs that we give for the amnesia that they don't, to prevent awareness.
It doesn't completely flush from the system.
It doesn't completely go from, and you really feel like you're mentating perfectly.
Right.
Yet he could not get home, you know, from an area he lived in for years. He could not really get home. So it's like you don't really realize. That's why we just say not to really make any important decisions, not to drive, really just to take it easy. You know, those first 24, 48 hours.
See, it's easy to say it's for insurance purposes, but it's not.
It's really for safety.
There's a practical reason for it.
But I'm heading for the jewelry store next time so I can forget I bought those diamond earrings.
Right. You want to forget you have to pay that bill?
That'll be the excuse, I'm sure. There are newer careers in anesthesia, positions that have come about in the last 20 years or so.
Pain management is a huge, that's probably the biggest change, I think, in medicine in general, just because of the invention of all these different techniques. That's really kind of the biggest change that I've seen, you know, in my training. You know, pediatrics, I mean, we're taking care of 24-week babies. You know, 24, you know, that's
oh my
a big,
gosh.
Big
yeah.
thing now, you know, these premature babies that are born at 6 months instead of 10 months.
But now you have the ability to do it.
Right, and they're doing really well, but they do come now for a lot more operative procedures.
Right.
That's, you know,
so the survivability of children or infants with what would have been fatal diseases or has improved dramatically.
Oh, dramatic. I mean, really dramatically. Just so now we're taken care of because they do have a lot more issues that need to be addressed. So those little ones are coming a lot more, you know, so that's really very advanced.
Right.
And that's recent history.
Okay. Well, we want to thank Dr. Betty Ann Robustelli for being with us. And this is something that I think we'd like to see more people aware of what you do. I'm sure that you as a profession would like to have people more attentive to your role in the operating room in their general care. And it's something that it's like everything. We give a lot more attention to the diamond ring that you're going to buy when you get out of recovery than the person who's going to put you to sleep.
Why are you looking at me while I say this?
Because you said it. Nobody else in the room said it.
We have to get more attention because they don't have any titling for the top doctors in Fairfield County, right?
Right.
There's no Academy Award for these doctors.
Okay. Well, we'll start a nomination.
We're
process.
Start a movement.
All right. Well, we want to thank Dr.
Thank
Betty Ann Robustelli for being
no
with
problem.
Us.
And my pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll be right back.
Please subscribe, recommend, and visit our website, healthyagingshow.com. Thanks for joining us at the Healthy Aging Show.